knowledge technology, and we use them in everyday life, like when I'm trying to play some computer game in the that there are millions or billions of transistors in my computer, and even in speakers too. And the advantage of this is they are small device, cheap and efficient, that can be mass produced to be put in a transistor. So today what I'm going to talk is, first I'm going to give an overview of what is exactly a transistor. And after, I'm going to explain how it works, and give an outline then of how we can use them. So what is a transistor? First, the thing is, we try to pass a current from A to B. And at first, this one acts like a resistance, a resistor. So what we're going to do is, we have a gate at C that modifies the resistance there. So it can be high, very high, or low, or even zero, well, approximately. So now I explain how it works. So we must do some solid state physics and talk about energy bands. So when we got the energy bands, if the energy bands are full, well, it can conduct because there's no free electron that is able to be used as a transport for the charge. And if you want to use them, we have to give them a lot of energy, which is harder. So this is the kind of isolator. With a conductor, it's the opposite. We have a lot of free electrons that are able to carry charge. And when there's a lack of electron, we call these holes, which are also able to carry charges, and they act as positive charge electrons. And then we have some semiconductors. We can build them by just heating the iron insulators so that it will just, because of statistical mechanics, there will be in both. But when we are making some semiconductors for using, well, practical use, we use those semiconductors, which are some pure insulator in which we add some stuff with more or less electrons, which are just making a small amount of holes and or a small amount of electrons. So that makes some stuff like that. So I'm now going to explain a bit how a transistor works, which is, this kind is a field effect transistor, specifically the type MOSFET. But every transistor has some similar working. It just, this one is the most useful one. So this is the one I'm going to explain. So we have a source and a drain, which we have both some negative doped semiconductors. And we separate it by a positive layer of doped semiconductor. So there the current may not pass because these are different carrier. These are electron, and here the holes are carrying the charge. So there's no way to pass the current. But that's here the gate. We can use it, because if we just charge it, it acts like a condensator, condenser. So if we put a positive charge on this one, what we're going to do is we attract electron there and push the hole down. So we make some negatively charged part, which is a conductive tunnel, so it allows to pass the current. So there we've got the current, and this is a less resisting material. So how to use them? First, one thing we need to know is It can be, depending on how much charge we put there, it can be more or less resisting. So one thing we may use is if we get a signal there, and here we have a really small signal, we can just use it to open the gate there, but release a small opening so that the current there is depending on the one there. So what we are doing is just there, the signal will be similar to this one, but much more stronger because we are using a power source there, which is much stronger. And another use, which is more useful in computation, is just as a switch. So what we're going is we have an input and an output, and we have a test signal there. So we are testing what is the signal. So I'll describe a bit more in detail what these things are. So because we can use these switches to build logic gates, and here are some examples of logic gates. Like this one is a AND gate, because the signal there, if it's positively charged, and this one is also, it can pass. So it just, both signal must be true, or there must be something in both, so that there's something at the output. And this one is the OR, because if one of them allows the current to pass, it will just pass. And the NOT gate is a bit more complicated, because what we're doing is, if the signal is true, this conduct is, we are just grounding our signal, so we don't have anything at the output. This is why the resistor is important there, but anyway. So I'm ready to conclude. The transistors are a very important application in solid state physics, because it's very useful in computer, because as we have seen there, we can do logic gates, and these ones are just the simplest ways to do logic things, but if we put a million together or something, we can do really complicated tasks and things like that. So the other one is we can amplify some signals, because as I stated before, we can just do that. And finally, in computation, this is what we use, and because they are really cheap and easy to build, and we can build a lot. So that's all. Any question? You?
Yes, in one of the first slides, you showed the symbol of a transistor in this third slide.
I lost. Is there a way to put this back?
The third one.
This is the symbol of a BJT transistor, not a MOSFET transistor.
Exactly.
So they should be CB and E. Collector, base, and emitter.
No, but ABC are just letters.
No. Gain, source, and drain represent another kind of transistor, MOSFET. This symbol is for BJT transistor. They're two separate.
Yeah,
but.
Okay,
the symbol doesn't matter. In one slide, you showed amplification and on off switch. Those two, yes.
This one?
Yes. May I ask, where did you get the left one? Because I think, are you sure about that? The amplified signal is the real one?
Well,
you know, in a small signal, those two terminals have exactly the same voltage. You must get the output voltage from above. The amplified signal is above, not here. Are you sure about this?
That's what I think. So,
are you sure?
Because the thing is, to build real amplificator, really amplified, good, we must add much more component to this, because
Otherwise, we're just folding. Does it have to be a voltage amplifier?
What?
Does it have to be a voltage amplifier?
It cannot amplify anything because those two terminals have exactly the same voltage in the small signal. So what you have to do is put a resistance down here and put a resistance down there. So the ratio of those resistors will be the amplification gain you get.
But these are the good thing, because if we look at the gate, we cannot pass a current from the gate.
Yes.
Here we just the signal we are trying to amplify. And this we can pass a huge current through this.
But it doesn't, okay.
Any other questions?
You should probably move on, right?
We have 1 minute to... Let's thank Julie.
Excuse me, that's the laser going to work on here.
Yeah, there is a...
So there is a problem.
No, I don't think there is a problem.
No, it works. It works.
So there's a button right in the middle here, which is the actual laser, okay? So you can do both forward and backwards, and you can use the button in the middle for the laser.
Propagation of photons. We can see that photonic crystal is similar to semiconductors because they affect the propagation of photons in almost the same way that semiconductors affect the propagation of electrons. But there are important differences that we should photonic crystal is able to provide complete tunability because in principle the defect in this kind of crystal can be designed in any size, any shape, so the dielectric content can be designed whatever you like. So the property of this crystal can be designed to any frequency of vision in terms of your own interest. And I think the essential property of this kind of crystal is that it's regularly repeating internal region, which has high or light dielectric constant. So mankind have already found a variety of ways to design this kind of crystal. And in this kind of design, then, the key point is to design the band gap. Humankind design the location and size of the band gap. The band gap will determine the property of the whole crystal. There are such kind of computational methods to design this kind of crystal. I'm not going to go details of, about all this details at all. As far as I know, most of these computational methods will only require a huge amount of computation, but there are already good softwares to do all this for us. And there are some applications of this kind of crystal. First is photonic crystal fiber, 2D, one-dimensional. As far as I know, this kind of crystal fiber is already being used in commercial. And 3D crystals, which haven't been used, haven't been applied, but researchers think it may be applied in optical computers. Then there are some weird phenomena found by this group in MIT. They perform a computational experiment which is shockwave crystal, photonic crystal. A shockwave is a type of propagation disturbance which can carry energies through a medium. And this is the shockwave they use in their model. The shockwave is determined by the dielectric constant. But I show this photograph here just to show you that this dielectric is dependent on the space, on the position, and also is time dependent. They found three weird phenomena. First is that, please look at this picture, and this is the frequency and this is the position of the crystal. So this is the position that they perform a shot from, and here is the light coming, and the light come off, but there is a shift in their frequency. They also found that the amount of frequency shift depends on the size of the band guide before the short wave. The second phenomenon is that they form localization of the light. The light is trapped for some time, and this period can also be carried. And the third one is that the bandwidth is narrow, and the slower the shock velocity is, the more the bandwidth is narrowed. This say that the bandwidth narrowing cannot be obtained by in other systems. I show this phenomenon here because I don't really understand the reasons they give. So maybe you guys can tell me. And this phenomenon has such properties. First, that in the whole experiment, no photon absorbed or re-emitted, and there's no measurement performed on the photon, only interacting photons which interact with the shock wave. So they guess that the state of the photons may not be changed significantly and may not be. So the quantum entanglement with another photon will be preserved. That's all. Thank you.
Time for another one question. Bruno?
Say that the opals could have an hexagonal or a cubic structure. The structure of the opal, you said that it could be hexagonal or cubic. Would that greatly alter the optical properties?
I'm not quite sure about this, but I think there are different kinds of opals.
Helix?
Yeah, so following that up, you do get different kinds of opalism. Some diffract red and some don't. So clearly it's not a property of the atomic structure, is it? It must be something to do with like high level domains or something. Is that right? Well, if it's a property of the crystal structure itself, then they'd all do the same thing, but they don't. So it can't actually be a property of the atomic structure. It's also the diffraction. It must be something else.
You mean?
So some opals diffract red light, and some don't. If it were an actual property of a crystal structure, then they'd all do the same thing. But I think it's probably some kind of like domain system, crystal structures. I don't know. I'm just guessing. But do you know anything about it?
So you mean some opals does not have that kind of structure?
So the one you showed didn't have any shimmering red on it. But some of them did.
Yes, but I think since opal is a mineral in a stone, so it kind of depends on the constant of the stone,
I think. Okay, unfortunately, we have to cut it short here, and our next speaker is Anna Kwai. Thank you.
And try to use the laser, guys. That way, if you use a laser, you can stand a little further behind and not block the screen as much.
And keep an eye on me.
Good morning, I'm Anna McCoy, and I'll be talking to you today about damping mechanisms in trees when they're blowing in the breeze. So, trees are all big and beautiful, and everyone likes them, but you don't really think about the dangers associated with trees until, like I was, caught out in a windstorm where the trees were falling all around me, and I almost got hit. Trees can fall on cars and destroy them, homes, people or even other trees knocking down other trees, causing a large chain reaction. And so damping in trees and effects of trees and wind have been studied for quite a while so that people can understand how it is that some trees survive windstorms and what it is that some trees will fall. So today I'll be talking about some of the effects that you happen when trees are in wind, and then how those trees survive those effects through damping and energy transfer. And then I'll be talking about a specific study that was done with a Douglas fir that had some actually surprising results. So there's an old saying that goes something along the lines of, the wind does not break a tree that bends, which is good advice, but it's also quite true for trees. Trees have to have a certain elasticity in order for them to bend in the wind so that they don't snap and break. Well, that elasticity will give rise to having it a certain oscillatory or harmonic oscillator behavior, but it's certainly not a simple behavior, particularly not when you're talking about a very dynamic wind system in addition to the tree system, which has a lot of different movements to it. So there's quite a complicated movement system there. But you also get some kind of strange effects, particularly when you're talking about wind. There can be a huge wind going, and the tree just slightly bends a little bit and hardly seems to be moving at all. Or there could be hardly any wind, and the tree's very agitated and moving insanely. So what's actually going on here? So basically what's presumably happening is that the wind, as it's dynamically changing, has a certain frequency to it. And if it matches the eigenfrequency of the tree, it passes energy very easily to that tree, which causes it to be agitated, even if there's not much wind. On the other hand, if the eigenfrequency of the tree doesn't match that of the wind, then it's not going to pass the energy in the same way and might just sort of bend it, depending on the elasticity of the tree overall. Another phenomenon that you will sometimes see is, so you take a branch and you pull it down a ways, you've bent it quite a ways, so the wood seems to be quite elastic, and you think it's going to snap back and oscillate quite a lot, but it doesn't. It just kind of floats back into place and sort of stops, which seems a little strange, but this is mostly due to all the built-in damping effects in a tree. There's about four types of damping effects that you'll get in a tree. The first is the aerodynamic, which is what you'd kind of expect. It's from all the foliage and the outer canopy of the tree, which can then cause sort of a drag force in the air and takes out the energy. The second type is the viscosity, the wood. Obviously, the wood is not that fluid and wants to go back to where it was before. Another type is if you have trees that are close together, as they hit and knock with each other in the wind, they're going to transfer energy one to the other, and that's another way that the trees can lose energy. But the fourth type is the one that I was most interested in, and it's the structural damping of the tree, or the damping that occurs because of the way that the tree grew. And this was what was looked at in a study done in 2007 by Spatz, Bursche, and Feitzfer. It was published in the American Journal of Botany in 2007. And what they did was they took a Douglas fir tree, attached a rope to it, and bent it over, and then released it looking at the motion. I am oversimplifying this study. They did a bit more complicated stuff to it. And what they observed was this movement here. So you have the time on this axis versus the relative displacement of the tree as it oscillated. And it dies out quite quickly. You're back to more or less equilibrium within about 6 seconds. They then took off the top 80 centimeters of the periphery of the tree so that they could get rid of the aerodynamic effect by getting rid of the leaves and the small branches. And then to look at the viscosity of the wood. And they did take into account the fact that they had chopped off some of the tree, and so they accounted for that. But what they found was that it oscillated quite a lot more, and it took more than twice as long for it to reach the same sort of level of dying out. And then they went back and, using images of the tree and various properties of the tree, assuming that you didn't have a major effect from the structural damping, that is, the tree more or less moved at the same frequency and all the branches moved with it, they then calculated what you would have had as an aerodynamic effect on the damping. And when they put the two together, they found that it wasn't anywhere near what you saw with the total tree. So that they postulated that what was happening was that the structural damping that occurred was actually playing a much larger role than people had previously thought. because up until this point, people had more or less said that it was just the aerodynamic and the viscosity of the wood that was causing the majority of the damping, and structural damping didn't play much of a role. So the way structural damping works is if you, much like the wind transferred energy to the tree, if the eigenfrequencies of the branches coming off of the main stem of the tree are close to that of the main stem, then it acts as a coupled oscillator and it transfers energy from the stem to the branches. Well then, again, if the branches coming off of the main branches are close in eigenfrequency, then the energy is again transferred. And so the energy is transferred out and spread out over the entire tree. You're not really losing any energy here, but you spread it out in such a way that allows the other mechanisms of damping to dissipate the energy much more quickly. So to test if this was actually the case, they went through and calculated the eigenfrequencies of the branch on the tree. What they found was that for a certain length, and what as shown here in this chart, it's length of branch versus the frequency or eigenfrequency of the tree, that for about 0.4 meters or longer, the eigenfrequency of the branches matched that of the tree shown here by this line. And so indeed, it does look like the structural damping is what was causing the very extreme damping effect that they saw in the tree. So this is a really interesting property for a tree to have, because it's a way for the tree to optimize damping without having to have a really large canopy or for an aerodynamic effect. And this will end up reducing the danger of the tree falling over in large gusts of wind, because if you have a large canopy, obviously it's going to be thicker and fuller. And as the wind hits it strongly, it's going to be more likely to knock the tree over. But that's not the case here. What you have here is a case where nature has evolved in such a way that it uses various types of damping to optimize the overall damping of the tree. As far as I know, no experiments have been done on other types of pine trees or even deciduous trees. But I strongly suspect that if they do, they'll find that this structural damping plays a much larger role than people have realized in the past. So next time you look at a tree, you can think about how cool it is and how much more intelligent it is than we are, because it actually figured out how to stay up in the wind. Thank you.
Yeah, so you said at the end that basically your concluding remarks were that the trees have evolved this way of withstanding wind, but when you were talking in the beginning, you were talking about how dangerous it can be when trees fall over. What's going wrong when trees actually do fall over and these natural factors don't work out?
Part of it is if the gusts of wind are just way too strong, it's obviously not going to be able to dissipate energy. In the case that I was talking about, it was about 80, 90 mile per hour winds, so it was, the tree didn't stand a chance, neither did I. Another thing that can happen is not all trees may have this property, and they may not be as have evolved the same way that this pine tree did. It may be that their eigenfrequencies don't match up in the same way, or that the wood might not be as viscous as the wood of this pine tree, and so it can't really using the other mechanisms either. Does that make sense?
So I had the interesting experience once I was camping and I was paddling along a lake, and what I noticed was that there were a whole bunch of trees. There must have been some small twists that had gone by, but a whole bunch of trees in one small area were all completely level, but at a certain height. Like usually we think of trees sort of falling at the base, but in this case they were all snapped off at roughly the same height, you know, like 12 feet in the air. Any idea what?
If I had to guess, and I'm not sure, I'd say that probably what happened was that the wood was elastic enough that it bent quite a ways in the wind, but that it pushed it over way too far, and that so it bent at a certain point in the tree and all snapped off. I'm guessing they were probably all about the same height, and that's why they
broke. Yeah, they were definitely similarly sized.
And it could also have been that, I don't know where this was, but if there was any snow on the tree, you can also find that the trees will go over and snap that way as well, which is why I've seen the cut off more often.
I would explain why I wasn't going to set up in a tree with a continuous stream of air rather than, say, a buffeting.
I'm not entirely sure about that one. I'd have to look into it further.
If there are any more questions, let's thank you.
I'm Lauren. I'm going to talk to you about spatial hearing and sound vocalization. And I'm really interested in this because, you know, we're thinking about things that happen, physical things that happen in nature. And I always think about how we navigate ourselves in nature. And a lot of that has to do with our ears and the way we perceive space orally. So things like hearing in three dimensions, and what's known as the cocktail party effect, that when you're at a place where there's a lot of competing sounds, sort of picking out the ones that are most important to you. And I think it's interesting, especially in our international context, that ears will favor the frequencies of human speech and even of the mother tongue. There's also this branch of physics, or maybe it's a branch of psychology, called the psychophysics, which is the scientific study of the perceptual system. So, you know, the ears are complicated, so I'm just going to give a qualitative overview of maybe more of the psychophysical, some of the theories that they use for sound localization or finding a sound in space. So there are cues that we use to find these sounds. Two of them are interaural time differences and interaural level differences. And these were two ways that we originally used to explain sound and where it comes from in space. And then later on came the more complicated head-related transfer functions. So I'll touch on those again after. And these are really comprehensive, and they include filtering of the head and torso, so frequencies, how they change when they bounce off your body, and a lot of that has to do with the pinna, or the outer ear. It comes from Latin, it means feather, which I think is cool. So this is our coordinate system. It's a spherical coordinate system with 0 degrees through your nose, 90 degrees to your right ear, and so on. So one of the first theories, you know, when a sound wave hits your ear, you notice two things, well, more than two things, but two of the things that you notice are changes in sound or loudness and changes in time, phase. So the interval or time difference is that when a sound source comes closer to one ear than the other, you hear a difference. And your brain processes this difference and uses it to localize the sound, which is pretty remarkable because it's usually on the order of like a picosecond or something. And this is found most useful to explain low frequencies. When you get higher, there doesn't seem to be a real trend. And then there's also the interaural level difference, which explains the sound intensity and how it differs when the source is closer to one ear than the other. And they say that the sound intensity is shadowed by the head in this way. And this can really only be seen for lower frequencies below about 1,000 hertz, which when you get to higher frequencies, the wavelength of the sound is comparable to the wavelength of your head. So the sound will just go past around and through the other ear, and you won't really notice that much of a difference. So Lord Rayleigh in 1907 decided that he could combine these theories to get a comprehensive theory for high and low frequencies and how we localize sound using them. And it started to be, you know, a good way to explain them. he used just pure tones, which isn't really the whole story. But then there's this cone of confusion that occurs. And this is simply that, you know, when sound waves hit your ears from far enough away, they reach it as a plane wave. So there's this cone around your head that you can't really tell where the sound is coming from. Is it there or there? Ambiguous. So that wasn't really enough. So they came up with these things called head-related transfer functions, which is, it really just, you know, you get a set of head-related transfer functions that it's like a whole spectrum depending on where the sound source is relative to your head. So they'll take different functions for when it's here, or here, or here, and sort of plot them together. And this relates the sound pressure level at the eardrum, so just the intensity of the sound at your eardrum, versus sound intensity at the point that is the center of your head as a reference point. And this takes into account what happens to frequencies as they reflect and refract across your body and inside the pinna in the ear. Okay, so here is a graph plotting the amplitude as a function of frequency. And these are some of the head-related transfer functions. And as you can see, you know, it sort of makes sense for low frequencies, that as you get to higher frequencies, it's not analytically described. But one thing we can see is that as the sound waves interact with your body, they interfere constructively and destructively. So you can see the peaks, they call them spectral peaks, where they interfere constructively, and spectral notches where they interfere deconstructively. And also what it means that the that this graph makes more sense for lower frequencies, that your ear doesn't reflect as much the lower frequencies. It just sort of funnels it in, which is why we prefer lower frequencies in general. And that's it. So, thank you.
In that plot, the last plot you had up, you said that it makes more sense at lower frequencies. But so which part of the plot are you talking about that makes sense, and why is it?
Oh, sorry. So, I mean, it just seems to, all of the plots for lower frequencies seem to be more on top of each other. It's obviously not perfect. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but it makes more sense. And as you get around here, they're more erratic. You can't really tell. The peaks and the notches seem to be at more of the same place earlier on.
So is there any simple way to understand why these curves are lying on top of each other for the first bit, for low frequencies?
I'm sure there is. I'm not really. Any other questions?
Did you draw any conclusions from the head data?
From the head data? No, I didn't. I measured everybody's head, and I was going to see what frequencies we could all, but everyone's head was pretty much the same, so I didn't think we could detect different frequencies.
You mentioned this cone of confusion, and I didn't quite understand how that works or what this is.
Okay, so if you have a source of sound that's somewhere in that direction, it can be a little bit above, below, to the right or left, basically around this cone that goes to a point in your ear, and it's a little bit ambiguous where that comes from, just based on... it's hard to determine.
Okay, when you're hearing a crowd, sometimes you can focus in hearing one sound.
Yeah.
Do you know how it works?
Well, there are a lot of things that contribute to your hearing, and a lot of them aren't really hearing-based, right? We have sight, and you could focus your attention, but that's more on the psychology end of it, I think. If you know that somebody is speaking to you, you know that you're supposed to focus on them. And
okay. if there's any more questions, let's start going again. How does this work anyway?
This, the arrows? Right, this is front, this, you know, go forward, go backward, and this is the replacement
arrows. Okay, thank you. Okay, hi everybody. I'm here to talk to you about the ideal body for swimming, which was a talk that was inspired by basically this picture of a swan calmly and effortlessly swimming across the Silver Lake. Well, here you can see the thing that I'm more interested in, which is the body shape. You can see how it has this characteristic streamlined form that allows for it to cut across the water like this. You can see here the water being spread away by the swan and how it works beautifully. So I wanted to see exactly how this body shape will be beneficial in detriment of other shapes, maybe simple, to the swimming of the animal, and it's reasonable to assume that this is because of drag, since an animal when swimming will want to reduce its drag while moving, so that it will spend less energy in its movement. So here my outline is just to give a little description of the theoretical fluid dynamics problem that is related to this, and then make some qualitative remarks and try to understand why this shape works. So I still have a few more examples of how the streamlined shape is everywhere in swimming animals. It is also in flying animals, but here I'm more interested about swimming. You can see here the duck and the fish. And, well, a picture of a diagram for a streamlined shape, so that you see how the water can flow around the body pretty easily. So let us try to gain some intuition as to why this shape would work over others. Well, I made some drawings with some shapes. Well, you can see that the square would probably not work. Well, the water seems to just go against that flat surface of the square and create a lot of drag there. A circle would probably be a little better. As you can see, there's a lot more flow around. We want the water to go around, not crash into the, so to say, into the shape. But there's still a little problem here near the front end. And you can see how supposedly this streamlined shape would work better. So, how to work with this with actual physics? Well, we'll have to go to fluid dynamics. I will consider then a viscous fluid flowing past an obstacle of an arbitrary shape, which is just a change of frame compared to swimming, which is the body actually flowing through an initially static fluid. It's an approximation, of course. Some other approximations will involve that we'll go to two dimensions because, well, it's easier and it has the important physics. And we'll have some boundary conditions for our problem, which are, well, the velocity to be of the fluid to be unperturbed very far from the body, and the condition that the fluid doesn't penetrate into the surface, which means that its normal component in the surface of the velocity will have to be zero. And I will apply these boundary conditions to the famous equations of hydrodynamics, the Navier-Stokes equations. Well, the first one is essentially the Newton's second law: acceleration equals force per unit volume. And then you have the continuity equation, which here is just represented by the divergence is zero of the velocity. Actually, that is for stationary flow. I'm considering stationary flow. I forgot about that. So you have those boundary
boundary conditions very well, and you could, in principle, solve the equation, and then you have the net force over there. You would just compute it by integrating over the surface, and you get the overall drag. Actually, for inviscid flow, you would find out that the net force over on the fluid is zero, and as such, you would have no effect. So this force would be drag, and you would be able to compare it, and you would be able to determine the most efficient shapes, right? Well, not quite, because as most Navier-Stokes problems don't actually have analytic solutions, so, well, I can't just solve the equations. But we can go through some qualitative remarks, which I'll do next. And of course, there's always the option of experiments and numerical simulations. I have here a picture of a very famous experiment, just to show. So, how does drag work? Well, there are essentially, I'll assume that we're dealing with low viscosity fluids, which is a reasonable assumption. It's water, after all. And for low viscosity fluids, we have this principle that internal friction will be really, really small from fluid to fluid, but it will be a little bigger from fluid to surface, so that there will be this boundary layer of fluid where the most drag will occur. And as such, we'll have two different sources of drag. One of them is pretty straightforward, is skin friction, when the fluid scrapes, so to say, against the surface, and the other one is pressure drag, which occurs due to the separation mechanism, which I'll now explain. Okay, so we have this picture of a flow, which I tried to draw more or less, and how does it work? First of all, we see that the boundary layer, which is near the surface, because of skin friction, it will get a little slowdown, but not only it is experiencing friction with the surface, it is also experiencing friction with the rest of the fluid around it. And that fluid is moving faster, and it's actually pulling the boundary layer away from the body as it curves away from the x-axis, which is the original direction of velocity. As such, you can see how the effect will work. It will be pulled away. It will be pulled away. The water near the surface, the boundary layer, and because of that, it will eventually separate. Now, what happens with this separation is that there will be here this area which is called the wake, where the fluid flow will be less coherent. Actually, if the viscosity is very low, you will experience turbulence, which is a very complicated phenomenon, by the way, and what happens is that this is not so effective in creating pressure in this direction as it would be as the pressure in this direction when the fluid encounters the body. So what happens is that there is more pressure for this side from here to here than from here to here, which will create some extra drag. That's what we call pressure drag. So how does this tell us how the shapes work? Well, essentially, what happens is that you will want for the surface to not have severe angle gradients with respect to that x-axis where the original velocity was. So you want to make the path of the water as smooth as possible, and you want it to not break away a lot, so that separation will become a lot later, and so that pressure drag can be reduced. That's how shape works. You can now easily see how, for example, a square would not be a very good idea, because there's an abrupt at the end of the square there will be an abrupt breaking of the an abrupt angle, and the separation will be very fast, and it will create a lot more pressure drag. A circle will be a lot better, but of course we can now see that a streamlined shape is probably the best, although I didn't give a very rigorous treatment. That's an open question, unfortunately. Well, maybe fortunately. So I guess that's all from me. Any questions?
measurement being wedge-shaped in both points. Do you think it would be a better shape or worse?
Well, where that's where my qualitative approach kind of fails. But, well, in principle, yeah. You could see, well, let me show you the picture of the duck again. The duck is a little more symmetrical than, as you can see, it's a little more symmetrical than the shape that I was showing there. Actually, I don't know if that was a wing or something. But in principle, yeah, I guess it would probably work like you say. Anyone else?
Yeah. Oh, I had the same question. What effects does the surface of bird have? You change the surface properties and material.
Right. I was good you asked that because I kind of forgot. That has to do with skin friction. A smoother surface will reduce skin friction. And it will reduce that part of the drag. Actually, you probably remember how swimmers in the Olympics a few years ago were allowed to use those shark skin or something swimsuits exactly for them to be able to swim a little faster.
So Poisson's law tells us that there's a zero velocity boundary condition right at the surface.
Just the normal component. It has to be tangential, so it won't go into the fluid, into the surface.
Right. So if I have liquid passing past a flat surface, that means that the velocity right at the boundary, right at the surface, mm-hmm. is zero.
Tangential. So it's tangential to the surface. Well, no. Wait. Actually, no. Yes.
Zero,
it has to be zero. It
zero
has to be actually
boundary.
Zero.
So then, what is actually meant by skin friction?
Well, I guess it has to be that effect will probably have to do with actually the tension from the fluid around it.
So it's maybe the skin friction is that whole region where, because the fluid flow profile actually looks like this.
Yes,
right?
Because the fluid is moving around it, but in the boundary, it's supposedly standing still with respect to the obstacle, so there will be a force there. I believe that's it.
Unfortunately, we have to move on, so thank you.
To present to you a water wave, because the world is full of waves, and as you know that there are two main types of waves, mechanical waves and electromagnetic waves. There are many examples of mechanical waves. For example, there are many examples of mechanical waves such as sound waves, water waves, and while light waves, television signals, X-rays are examples of electromagnetic waves. And today, I just want to concentrate on a typical example of mechanical waves, water waves, a water wave. I'm going to divide my presentation into two main parts: propagation of vibrations, and the second one is types of waves. And finally, you and I will find out whether a water wave is transverse or longitudinal. Now let's move to the first part. Propagation of vibration. This is a feature. Oh, sorry. Can I come back to the first feature? As you see that this is a feature I took yesterday at Waterloo Park, and it is the picture of, as you see, there are many shapes of waterways on the surface. There are many ways to create a water wave. If you drop into the lake, a gentle lake, a storm, and at the position the stone hit the surface, I want to use the flag. Sorry. Here at the position the stone hits the surface, I call this particle is A. And as you know that water particles bound to each other, so I have many particles here, C, D, E, and so on. When A tends to move on, and I can see that here it's half, it moves up, and because it bounds particle B, therefore it will pull B goes toward, and then when A comes back to original position, B will move up and C, and when B moves up, it will pull C too, and so on. You have the shape of the wave and so on. And here I assume that I am using one-dimensional. The wave is moving along the x. And imagine that we have, when we look at the whole surface of the lake, you will see here's A. And all the set of all particles have the same distance. Have the same distance to A. I call B. Here is all B. And if all particles here rise up, so here we have crest. And if a set of particles move down, I will have a trough. And here's the picture. You will see crests and troughs here. So I have one question is that if I have a leaf on the surface of the lake, which direction will it move? Actually, it doesn't move along the direction of the wave when the wave travels on the surface, because particles of surface just moves up and down. Therefore, the leaf just moves up. So, in conclusion, a wave is just only the propagation of vibration of particles. And there is one thing I want to mention is that the difference between mechanical waves and electromagnetic waves is that a mechanical wave needs a material, a medium, so that the wave can transform. Therefore, a water wave will not exist without water particles. And now let's move to the second part, types of waves. I want to mention again, I'm talking about mechanical waves. So there are three types of mechanical waves. The first one is transverse, and the second one is longitudinal. And the difference between these two types is that in transverse wave, particles of the medium will move perpendicular to direction of the wave, while with longitudinal waves, the particles will move along along the direction of the wave. And there is a third type is that I don't know what do they call this type, but in this type, the particles of the medium will move around in a circular, in circle. And they said that water wave belongs to the third part. It means that the particles, the molecules in the surface, on the surface of a liquid will move around, and the molecules on the crest will move along with the direction of the wave, while the particles on trough will move opposite to the direction of the wave motion. So we can say that a water wave is a combination of transverse and longitudinal. That is my presentation. Thank you for your time. Molecules on crest will move as the same direction of wave motion. And as I mentioned that molecules, particles must move up and down. It does not move along with the wave motion. Therefore, to keep preserve their position, the trough must move opposite direction to the wave motion. And I don't know why they move. One wave is belongs to the third one.
There are any more questions? Then
all right, my name is Trevor Rempel, and today I will be discussing how candles burn. So first I'm going to ask the question, where does the wax go when you burn a candle? And I thought this was interesting because I was thinking about it, and I'm like, well, I don't really know what happens to the wax. So, and in answering this question, I'm going to discuss a concept in fluid mechanics called capillary action, which is based on cohesion and adhesion. And then I'll use some fluid mechanics to calculate the height to which a liquid would rise in a small tube. After that, I'll give the rest of the story on how a candle burns and then review what I've done in the conclusion. So candles are a common household object. We've seen them a lot, you know, blow them out at your birthdays and that kind of a thing. And you've all lit a candle before. So here's my candle. And as you know, you light the candle, and this, so you have the candle, and then when you light the top, it melts a small puddle of wax at the base of the wick. And then, you know, the candle burns until all the wax is gone. but where does the wax go? You know, you have never seen a candle. The wax doesn't pool out the sides and make the base really big at the end when you're done melting, and it obviously doesn't just vanish. So where does it go? And the answer is capillary action. And it's the tendency of a liquid to rise against the force of gravity. And actually, you can see the picture a bit bigger here. So you can see that if only gravitational effects were taken into account, all the liquid should be at the same height as this large beaker here, but they're not. You can see that here especially, it's much higher. So that is the tendency of liquids to rise against the force of gravity. And it's actually a relatively common phenomenon. You see it anytime you use a paper towel or a sponge. You know, you stick a paper towel or sponge in water and it absorbs the water. That's this effect. Or if you've ever bought like Under Armour or special sports clothing that claims to wick sweat away from the surface of your skin, that's the same phenomenon. So how does it work? Well, in a fluid, you have what are called cohesive forces. And these are forces between like molecules, and they're responsible for surface tension. So again, you can see this bigger here. You can see that this is water, right? So water molecules, there's forces between the water molecules that hold them together quite strongly, even enough to support the weight of this paperclip. And on the other hand, you have what are called adhesive forces, and these are intermolecular forces between unlike molecules. So for example, this is why you need to dry your hands. And this picture I thought was an excellent example of both. You can see the cohesion here in the fact that the water molecules form bubbles like that. And you can see the adhesion as they're sticking to this plant. And on the other hand, you have something like mercury, which is extremely cohesive, as you can see these globs that it forms here, but not very adhesive because you can see that it doesn't form puddles like it would if I put water in there. And you may have heard somebody say the expression, you know, water is wet, which sounds like a dumb thing to say, but it's actually not, because water is a very adhesive liquid, and that's why you have to, you know, dry your hands after you wash them or dry yourself off after you take a shower. If you, for example, showered in mercury, you wouldn't have to. It would just run off because it's not adhesive at all. So now, using these two concepts, we can consider liquid in a tube. So suppose that I have a small tube immersed in a liquid. In the case that I'm discussing, the tube can be the wick to the candle, and this liquid here would be the wax that the flame has melted. So the cohesive and adhesive forces work together to produce this kind of a shape. Because what happens is the adhesive forces between the wax and the wick will want to pull the wax up the wick. On the other hand, the cohesive forces will want to hold the wax together. And so that's why you get this kind of a concave meniscus forming here. So, and using some equations in fluid dynamics, we can actually calculate, I don't know what happened. My equation vanished. All right, I'll just tell you what it said. So what we have here is just this picture. Just now, I've displayed it like this to make it clear. You have H here is the height to which the meniscus has risen. This angle here is called the joining angle, and it's the angle at which the meniscus meets the side of your tube. A here is the radius of the tube, basically a measure of how wide it is, whereas R here is the radius of curvature of your meniscus. And to make my life easier, I assume that the meniscus was hemispherical. So what this should say is that simple geometry will give you that the radius of curvature is just the radius of the tube divided by the cosine of this joining angle here. Now, as you can see from this equation, we discussed this one actually yesterday, that the change in pressure across a fluid is equal to twice the surface tension divided by this radius of curvature here. So combining these two equations, you can get that the change in pressure, I'm going to have to work this out here. So radius of curvature, I don't know what happened to my equations. But anyways, change in pressure is just twice the surface tension multiplied by the cosine of this joining angle divided by this radius here. On the other hand, we know Bernoulli's equation, which says that the change in pressure is the density of the liquid, of the fluid, multiplied by its height, multiplied by the acceleration due to gravity. So, putting this all together, you can get an expression for the height of the liquid, which is twice the surface tension times the cosine of this joining angle, divided by the acceleration due to gravity times the radius here of the tube times the density. And actually, this is why we can look at this picture again. Here, the width of the tubes gets smaller as it goes along. And that expression that I just derived says that the height to which it rises goes as 1 over the radius. So that's why the smallest radius tube has risen it to the highest. So that's also why you don't see really gigantic wicks on candles. Otherwise, it wouldn't be able to pull up the liquid very well. So now that we understand that, we can explain the rest of why a candle burns. Okay, once the wax is melted, this capillary action draws the wax up to the top of the wick, like that. Then, heat from the flame evaporates the wax into the air, and so actually the wax is being evaporated like you would boil water or something like that, but uses this concept. And this process will then continue until the wax runs out. So, in conclusion, we discovered that a candle relies on this concept of capillary action. After we initially melt the wax, the adhesive force between the wax and the wick draws the wax up the wick, and then the heat from the flame evaporates the wax. And that's it. Any questions?
So is that why most wicks are covered, coated in wax? Because it would be
crazy. Yeah. Well, like, yeah, the wax will be drawn up the wick, and so there's actually wax in the wick. Like it's a similar concept as long as it's porous. So. Yeah?
So does the wax interfere with the actual stuff that the wick is, you know, just the metal or whatever you remember?
Well, like the wick is just really just like a string or a, like anything really that'll burn. So like you initially light the wick and then that'll cause the, like once you melt the wax, the capillary action will draw it up to the top of the wick.
There's no
casting
or anything
like
that inside of the
wick? No, I don't think so.
Well, sir, is the thing because of the wax being drawn up the wick that it takes so long for a candle to burn? Because,
yeah.
You know, I'm sure if you just took a string and you burned it, it couldn't last nearly as long.
Yeah. So it's like if you've ever like squirted your hand with bug spray and lit it on fire, it's the bug spray that burns, right? In this case, it's the wax that's burning, right?
Right.
So it prevents the wick from burning. If you had like a poor candle and if the wax got blocked, then the wick would burn and fall off or something like that.
Isn't the wax fuel?
Pardon?
The wax does not just evaporate. I think that it is actually fuel. It's a thing that's burning.
Yeah,
the string is there just to hold wax.
Yeah.
And wax is thing that burns.
So yeah. So. Yeah, the wax, like, but initially it's the wick that's burning.
Yeah,
like
as soon as but then what gets consumed?
Yeah, is the wax, yeah. The heat from the flame, like, the initial flame melts the wax and draws it up, and then after that point, it's the wax that keeps the flame burning.
Shane?
Yeah. Awesome. I have a pretty good second question. Is,
any more questions? Let's thank Trevor again. That concludes our morning session, our first session. We're now going to have a small break and meet back here before 10:40 because we want to start our next session right at 10:40.
So if I can make just one more quick comment. So the problem that you had with the equations is something that happens all the time. It's because when you switch from one computer to another computer, often the fonts don't carry over. So you're all, I assume, quite familiar with using LaTeX. There's a really, really nice bit of freeware that I started using, which is phenomenal, which is called, it's a program called LaTeXEd. Okay? And it's just like a little standalone box that where you enter in LaTeX script, and then when you make the equation that standalone box, all you do is just drag it right onto your PowerPoint or Keynote or whatever. And it just creates a little JPEG even transparent if you want, with transparent background. It's a phenomenal little program for those of you that are familiar with LaTeX. It's not LaTeX.
It's Mac only.
Is it Mac only?
Yeah, but there are some similar things.
Oh, there should probably be. Yeah.
Well,
okay.
Okay, we have about less than about 15 minutes.
Is there, if you want to put your writing sheets back, please add them on the table.